What's up, everyone? On this next episode, we have newly named interim head coach, Shay Jones, of Phoenix College. Coach Shay has coached all over the United States for multiple levels. He came to Phoenix College about 7 years ago, where he's helped out both the men's and women's programs. He's going to share his journey through coaching, where his drive as a player came from, what it's been like since moving from the assistant coach to the head coach, and more. Let's roll it back and hear how it went. All right, Coach Shay, so tell me, when did you know that you wanted to be a basketball coach, and how did you get your first go at it?
Well, I knew that I wanted to coach basketball growing up. You know, I was born in Columbus, Ohio. I grew up in Ohio. Well, not grew up in Ohio. I was in Ohio till like first or second grade. And out there, everything is Ohio State and everything is Woody Hayes. So I was indoctrinated to the idea of coaching at a very early age. My grandfather was a coach, and being from that environment, I knew what coaching entailed, you know. So then after the blizzard of, I think it was 78, we moved to Las Vegas, and that's when I was introduced to basketball. And I would, at that time, running Rebel games would come on, I think around midnight they would come on. So I started staying up and watching the games. And I just, you know, everybody fell in love with the players, but I just fell in love with Coach Tarkanian, and just, you know, the way that he had everything under control and everyone listened to him and everyone hung on every word that he said. I just thought it was the most amazing, powerful thing I'd ever seen. I was just blown away by it. And as I got older, learning the game and being a part of the game and all that stuff really, really got me more interested, obviously, from a player's perspective. And then I was fortunate enough to interact with, you know, some great players, Reggie Theus in particular, just taking the time out with me as a young guy and spending time with me. And I just really, I saw the impact of that. And I always said I wanted to be like that when I got older. I wanted to help young people, reach out to young people. And it just snowballed from there. So, I mean, as far back as I can remember, I've wanted to coach. You know, I wanted to coach, you know. So I started working basketball camps when I was about 18 or 19. You know, obviously I was at an, I have a younger brother who was an all-state player in Las Vegas, and I would coach him and his teams. And the point guard off of his teams, one of my dearest friends, was probably the first player I actually coached, like really sat down with him after games and talked to him about things and why you do this and why you don't do that and leadership and all that kind of stuff. And unfortunately, he passed away the day after Christmas in 1995. And he's been a kind of like my guardian angel ever since, you know. But he was the first person that I realized, you know, my brother had to listen to me, I guess, you know, but Roderick was, he was the first person that would seek advice from me, would hang on every word that I had to say, like Coach Tarkanian experience. So that was when I realized that this is what I want to do until my last breath, you know?
Wow. Yeah, no, I hear you. It's funny, you know, when you and I first got connected, you were the assistant at Phoenix College. And, you know, now that we're finally recording an episode, you're the interim head coach. So how did that happen?
You know, it's funny. It things transpire and transpire so quickly. You know, I'm sure you've probably heard of this. One of my, you know, my best friend, Anthony Stewart, who's the head coach, University of Tennessee Martin, tragically passed away a couple of months ago. One of the worst days of my life. It was horrible, you know, and, you know, in this profession that we're in, and, you know, these are not just people we work with. These are our friends, our family, you know? So I started getting, I was just overwhelmed with text messages and phone calls all of a sudden. And one of my former players said to me, "Coach, have you talked to Stu?" So when I saw that, I panicked, and the game was on television. And I saw his name come across the bottom of the ticker, and my heart just fell. And I went probably from that moment for the next 3 weeks, probably the worst experiences of my life. It was just horrible. I went back to Ohio for the funeral and things were just horrible. While I was there, one of my former players in Michigan died in a car accident, and I just thought life couldn't get any worse. It was just horrible, not to mention having lost people due to COVID. The pandemic was really going crazy, social justice issues. It was just a real, real bad time. One of my dearest friends, who was the former head women's basketball coach at Phoenix College, Christy Kincaid, she called me and told me that the vice president would like to speak with me. And, you know, me being me, I'm like, oh my God, what now? Like, you know, I get on a Zoom call with them the following day, and they had decided to make her the athletic director and asked me if I would be interested in running the program. I've spent 95% of my career coaching men's basketball, had tremendous success. When she asked me to step in and help as her associate head coach, I was like, well, I want to make sure I'm doing this right, because I have so many close friends that I respect the women's game. I see it as its separate thing. I don't see it as the understudy to men's basketball. One of my good friends is the head women's basketball coach at UNLV. Her father was my mentor. I just love the women's game. I respect it. And I didn't want to do it a disservice by coming in and trying to do what I've done with the men for the women and just force the square peg into a round hole. I wanted to make sure I was doing things right. And, you know, I'm always afraid that, oh my gosh, I can't yell at them. And, you know, I'm going to say the wrong thing and this, that, and the other. But quickly I realized, you know, what I had a hunch is that, you know, coaching is coaching. X's are X's and O's are O's. And what I sit down with Marcus Banks and talk about with is no different than what my point guard last year deals with. His skill set takes over in the moment of impact, but you're pretty much teaching the same thing 95% of the time. So I quickly felt very comfortable. And I remember saying to the ladies after we lost in the tournament, you know, I never thought I would coach women's basketball. You know, I've been petrified all my adult life of having a daughter because of the stress. And my wife jokes and says, now you have 20 daughters, you know. But I told them, I said, you know, every man wants a son, but every man needs a daughter. And it was the greatest thing that probably happened to me in my coaching career. Is it gave me an opportunity to not have to force players to buy in. On the women's side, they come pre-bought in. You know, they really, really, it's, you know, they care about the person sitting next to them. They want to be a part of this family. They want to have that sense of belonging. Whereas with the guys, a lot of times, more often than not, they're coming with the mentality that they are going to save this program. They are going to be the one that makes this work. Whereas women come in and they tend to have a mentality is like, okay, what do I need to do to help? And that's always been my approach. And very few guys really have that approach. So I've spent a lot of season after season really, really breaking a guy down to get him to understand, to buy into that and how to put something before yourself. Whereas I came into an environment where that was just completely, completely prepackaged. And I was so excited about that from the very beginning. So it snowballed. You know, I remember someone saying to me, I think this is a great move for you. And before you know it, you'll be a head coach. That was a little less than a year ago, you know? And so here we are. So it really, really caught me by surprise, but I was prepared for it. You know, I've been preparing for most of the friends that I have that are head coaches, they say they weren't actively pursuing head coaching opportunities when the opportunity presented itself for. You know, so they always told me, be ready, be ready, be ready. So I've been preparing myself over the last few years for that. And thank God for the advice that a lot of them gave me, because I believe now that I'm more prepared than I've ever been to run this program. Mm-hmm.
So I listened to your athletic department's podcast with you, and mm-hmm. you know, there was lots of good stuff there. And what really caught my attention was your explanation of yourself as an athlete in high school, right? I believe you said you were mediocre, but <Yeah. laughs> but then you decided to go back to college and play for your friend who passed away, and you know, your work ethic changes. And yeah. Fast forward through your career, you end up becoming this professional ball player who gets their college jersey retired, just flat out amazing. And you know, how did your work ethic change? What was that grind to jersey retirement like? Because that doesn't just happen, especially to someone who would identify themselves as a mediocre athlete.
You know, it's funny. Sometimes I think about things that have happened on the court, or you know, I'm playing, you know, with pros, or you know, I'm playing with NBA guys, and I do something, and after the fact, I think to myself, oh my God, I shouldn't try that, because I psychologically still don't see myself on that level. But hours and hours and hours and hours of doing something over and over and over until you get it right really allows you to almost work. It's almost like an out-of-body experience. You know, I still recall daily Coach Washington in high school getting upset because I'd go 3 or 4 times in a row and I couldn't initiate the offense. I couldn't make the first pass to the wing. I couldn't make the high post entry. I mean, it would get stolen literally every single time. And the guy is guarding me. I love him to death. One of my best friends. I've known him since I was 14. Marcus Jenkins was one of the best offensive players in the city. He was not a good defender, and he was barely breaking a sweat. He was still the ball for me every single time. And I would think to myself, why can't I just make a simple pass? You know, and it was just mind-boggling to me that something so simple was the bane of my existence as an athlete. So I remember after my senior year, wanting to just be able to come down, make a pass to the wing, and that would make me feel like a player. And as I slowly but surely got that, then I wanted to be a guy that can just pull up in the middle of the paint amongst the big guys and knock down a mid-range jump shot or floater. And slowly but surely, these little things, these little tasks became reality. And at one point in time, I would say I was probably about 22. I was playing with some of the Rebels and I'm running up and down. And I remember it like it was yesterday. Gerald Patio played on our Final Four teams at UNLV. He was like, we got Che, come with us. Che's with us. And I remember thinking to myself, I just got picked by an NBA guy. And I looked back and I was like, I've become a legitimate player. And I was like, wow. And I didn't really focus on that. It just happened just because doing it over and over and over. So then I was like, you know what? I'm going to work on this. And I had these visions of going to college to play. And, you know, I was playing semi-pro baseball and it just kind of was slow, you know, because now I'm focusing on it and it's not happening. So it seems like it's moving in like molasses, like, you know. So I'm like, yeah, you know, I keep going to, I'm at parks all the time. I'm at gyms all the time. I'm playing all the time. And everyone's like, people around town be like, you played in Vegas? I don't remember you. And I know why they say that, because I wasn't the guy on the floor. It was Marcus Jenkins and LeVan Lied and Isaac Brown. And all of these guys are the guys that you saw. You didn't see me. You knew I was on the team, but you didn't see me, you know? And then as the guys that I went to school with were coming back around and I was able to compete with them, I was able to take the ball from them. I was able to score on them. I was able to make them do what I wanted to do. I was like, wow, I can do this, you know? So then I really, really decided, you know what, I'm going to try to do this. So I worked at it, gave up baseball, worked at it. I got better and better and better, but I just didn't have any opportunities, any connections. And it was literally, we call him Sinclair. Roderick passed away on the 26th. And I remember the morning of the 27th. It was the morning after we'd received the phone call. And we were still kind of in shock, teary-eyed, and, you know, and we went to his house, and we were at his house, and I was walking down the hallway, and I noticed his mom had some things hanging up, like memorabilia type stuff, you know, from the state championship, you know, college stuff, you know. He was playing at Eastern Washington at the time. They were supposed to actually be playing on national television that day. And I was like, man, I know what I would like to do. I would like to be on the floor playing for him right now. And that's when it came to me. I was like, I'm going to go to college and play for him. And at that point in time, anything, any obstacle that I faced, I wasn't facing it for myself. I was facing it for him. And it was kind of like, are you going to let him down? You're just going to tuck your tail and run because it's difficult? You know, and it became this challenge to me to celebrate him and celebrate his life and celebrate just him providing this opportunity for me. And I knew that I wanted to coach. I knew that if I wanted to coach, I had to get a degree. And I knew that being a poor kid from North Las Vegas, the only way I was going to get a degree is if I had an opportunity to pay for college. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of how that happened. And the next thing I knew, I was, you know, working on getting to the basket going left. I was working on being able to catch and shoot the three ball. I was working on being able to pick up guys bigger, faster, stronger than me, 94 feet. And every time it got difficult, it was forced in. It was forced in. It was forced in. It was forced in. And that, I've held on to that. I remember just as recently as, you know, a few weeks ago when I was, you know, our back to play protocols, as I was doing that stuff and it was difficult. I was getting tired. I thought to myself, man, I'm doing this for sin, you know, and it's just become such a part of my life that, you know, wasn't some, you know, insanity BX 90 or something. It was just really something as simple as my friend isn't here. These were his dreams. I'm taking over his dreams and I'm going to take it as far as I can possibly take it. You know?
Yeah, that's amazing. I mean, you know, it sounds like you not only had that motivation through your friend, but you also, you know, you put in the work. You became so meticulous with your training. You know, you wanted to become an expert at the left-handed layup. And then when you finally got that down, you know, move on to the next thing, the pull-up. Yeah. Okay, I got that down. Where, you know, you don't necessarily see that very often as far as when people are out there training to become better ball players. They want to work on everything, right? They want to be a jack of all trades, master of none. But no, that's awesome, especially that you were able to, you know, in turn, if eventually live out your friend's dream.
Yes. It's still kind of crazy to me. You know, I went back to campus and they gave me my jersey in the plaque, and it's been hell 25 years. And I look at it still and I'm like, what? It's just, I don't know. It's really crazy. And I used to hate when I hear people say stuff like that. You know, I hear, you know, not compare myself to Michael Jackson, but I hear Michael Jackson say, yeah, sometimes I'm just dancing and I don't know how I do. And I'm thinking to myself, yeah, right. How do you not know? It's your song. Like, you know what I mean? But I think also as I've gotten older and, you know, really the funny thing is as I've gotten older and I still play, and, you know, a guy was telling me that, you know, he's too old to be out here. He can't do it. I said, I'm the oldest person out here. You got one more game. And when I say that I'm 50, he's like, what? So the guys are always kind of like, I can't believe that you're 50. My dad's 44. My dad's 40 or something like that, you know? And that has kind of put it more into perspective for me because, as I said, I wasn't a Street and Smiths All-American. I wasn't All-League, All-City. You know, none of that stuff. So for me, you know, I literally went from fan to player. You know, it's kind of like that, what's that Bow Wow movie, Like Mike?
Yeah. Yay! Oh my gosh, what's his name? Calvin?
Calvin, that's it, that's it.
All right. So you've coached all over the place, you know, seen a lot of different styles of play and talents, and I mean, I'm sure you have. And then you end up at Phoenix College, where you are an assistant on both sides, right? So men and women. Yes. I mean, how did you do it? I'm sure the teams obviously played very differently. And I'm not talking about because they're men and women. I mean, I'm just talking about, I know that the men's team there is a powerhouse and the women's team isn't, you know, quite there yet. Hopefully you'll get them there. But how did you manage that? That's two different sides of the coin.
Well, just to make sure that we're clear, I wasn't doing them concurrently. I did one and then came back and did the other.
I see. Okay. So one season with men.
I was with the men up until 2018. And then the 2019 season, I wasn't coaching. Our staff completely left. And I wasn't coaching the 2019 season. I came back, which was last season, as the associate women's coach, and now to present day. So I wasn't doing them both at the same time.
Okay, so then, what was that like then, that transition from being, you know, a part of this men's powerhouse team and then switching over to the women's side?
You know what? On paper, it's astonishing. It's crazy. It's, why would you do that? And I wasn't so sure that I wanted to do it, you know? But it's like, it's muscle memory. Once, you know, and I work primarily with point guards, and you know, once I explain, cause angles are angles, you know, there's nothing we do as point guards because someone's 6'8" or because someone's 6'2". We do what we do because that's the way it's supposed to be done. You know, little things like, you know, driving the ball at the outside, at the top foot, or whatever it may be, you know. We do these things because that's the way you're supposed to do them. So when you see players struggling with why they can't do something, my niche has always been to, it's that little thing that you're doing that I can break that down to you, remove that from your game, and show you how to put in the piece that fits. It's just, sometimes it's just as simple as, you know, you're hesitating before you spin move, or you're going right into the spin move and you're not letting that defender get off to the other side of you. Little things like that. And sometimes those are, it's almost like a golf swing, like someone has a mental block. And I've always been able to kind of pinpoint those little things and really, really talk to a player. So that is what my coaching style is about. My coaching style is about seeing you, seeing what's holding you back and not letting you break through that next level, and then working on that. So, and that is, my son is 12 and I help with his AAU team. And it's the same thing with 11 and 12 year olds that it is with some of my guys that I have playing overseas right now. And sometimes it's the same exact thing. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I had a kid who, you know, he's post kid, 6'11", dunking on everybody, but he always gets the ball knocked away because he wouldn't chin it. Well, I have a kid on my son's team and love him to death. He looks like a monster out there. He's all a 5'9", like, you know what I mean? But he looks like a monster out there with 11 and 12 year olds, but he does the same thing. He won't chin the ball. And he chinned the ball a couple of weeks ago, and man, he's out there looking like an All-American. So that's always been my thing. You know, I'm not a yeller, you know, I do, you know, cuss, you know, not excessively, but I express myself, you know. But the one thing that I think has always separated me from other coaches is I've always been able to find that little thing that is holding a player back and connect to that zone in on that. And when I got out there within, say, maybe two or three practices, I was in that zone again. And I was like, okay, look, this is what I need you to do. You know, whoa, come here. I need you to do this. I need you to do that. Don't do this. Do this. And then, you know, communicating with players and communicating with one another and when to draw the line, when to put your foot down and all that kind of stuff. It's no different, whether it's JUCO, Division I, men, women, young, old, professionals, amateurs. The game is the game, and none of us are bigger than the game, mm-hmm. you know?
Yeah, I mean, and just to touch on I think that you're absolutely right. I mean, the game is the game. When we're talking about different levels, sometimes even men and women, I feel like really the only difference is how that message is received. Yeah. You know, that's pretty much it. But the message is the same. It's just, you know, how is it received from player to player? But throughout your career, I'd like to know who are some, you kind of touched on this already, but who are some mentors that you've had, or more specifically that you've personally known and you've looked to for advice, and what has stuck with you?
Well, the reason that I even like basketball is because of Jerry Tarkanian. When I was coaching in Ohio, we were number one in the nation. We ended the season 29-2. We just really dominated. I mean, six guys off that team ended up playing professional. You know, we have arguably the best junior college team to ever come out of Ohio. That team was phenomenal. At one point in time, Ohio State players, and they were loaded. I mean, they had like Brandis Fuss-Cheatham, J.J. Sullinger. They had like legitimate guys on this team. You know what I mean? And they would come over and play with us, and we go over their place. And our guys, you couldn't tell which team was in the Big Ten and which team was a JUCO team. That's how good our team was. You know, we were 24-0, and my mother had talked to Mrs. Tarkanian and talked to Coach, and Coach gave me a call. And we talked a little bit, Coach Tarkanian and I, and I said, you know, we're 24-0, and we play bad, and we beat teams by 20, and I'm afraid that's going to catch up to us. You know, do you have any advice of what we should be doing in practice? And he was very simple with this. He said, you should be doing what you've been doing. He said, don't change anything. He said, when I was a young coach, we were really good. This is back in Riverside. And he said, I have this military assistant, and he was like, we do the same thing every day, whether we win or whether we lose. And he said, I thought that was crazy. He said, but I didn't listen, and I tried to change things up, and I ended up costing us a season. He said, you do what got you there. And if what you're doing is the right thing and you got the right people in place, things will work out. He said, but when you start trying to get too fancy, you outcoach yourself. Mm-hmm. And that's a big mistake. And that always stuck with me. Always stuck with me. That was one. My personal mentor is not only just a basketball coach, but just as a human being who's really taught me everything that it entails to be a coach, to be the husband, to be the father, to be the best friend, to be the mentor, to be the guy learning. All of that stuff is hands down Al LaRock in Las Vegas. His daughter, Lindy, played at Stanford. She's the head coach at UNLV now. And I remember at 26 years old when I decided I was going back to college, everybody had something negative to say and or just something to say, you know. And I ran into Coach one time, and he said, so what's up with you? I said, I'm thinking about going back to college to go play. You know, I know I'm older, but I want to play. And he looked me right in the eyes. And he was like, okay, when do you leave? And if you know Coach LaRock, that's how simplistic everything is to him. And that was all I needed. And it just gave me so much energy to finalize everything, set it up, and I was out. I was gone within a matter of 4 months. I was in Ohio. And, you know, he was really, and he's been that way in almost every, I don't think there's been anything that has happened significantly in my life in the last 25 years that wasn't run by Coach LaRock, my brother, my wife. Those are the people that if they give a thumbs up on it, then I'm full go ahead with it. You know, he's just been unbelievably, the impact he's had on my life has been tremendous. And I think you see it with my sons. You see it obviously with the way that I love my wife and cherish my wife and all that stuff, because I was able to stand by him and learn from him, you know. And then the last person would definitely be as any coach will tell you, the last person definitely, you know, not least, but the last person definitely has to be my wife. Leslie has, you know, you hear that joke, you know, she wasn't in there shooting the jump shots with them. Well, let me tell you, my wife couldn't run across the street and back without needing a Gatorade and a defibrillator. But she was in the gym with me. You know, free throws, jump shots, she'd be in the gym late nights with me, hanging out with me, and never, ever complain. Why are you in the gym? What are you doing in the gym? We don't spend time together, none of that kind of stuff. She was extremely, extremely, extremely supportive. Now she's in a house with three guys, you know, two football players, a basketball player, you know, just, you know, but she's still the boss here, you know, and she's held me down from the very beginning. You know, I'm talking about going to Ohio to go to college, going overseas to play, coaching in Wyoming, in Michigan, Ohio, back to Vegas, out to Arizona, Flagstaff, Phoenix, all these different places, right? And she's been a source of support that I know that not only did I not always have, but a lot of young Black men from the places that we grow up in this country, we don't have a lot of support like that. And she supported me in everything that I wanted to pursue, from my basketball to my doctorate, all of that stuff, right? But never ever condoned anything stupid that I wanted to do. And I think that's a very fine line that that a person, that your best friend, has to walk. And a lot of times we fail each other on that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, that's great. That's you're definitely blessed there to have such a great support system, and it sounds like just awesome mentors who really see a lot of greatness in you.
Yeah.
So here's a basketball question for you. You know, I haven't really asked one of these on my podcast, but because this is quote unquote season two, I figured I'd throw one out. All right. So your team is down by three. Okay. There's 5 seconds left and you call the timeout. Now, my question is, down by three, 5 seconds left, do you draw up a play for your knockdown three-point shooter who is 0-for-6 on the game? Or do you drop a play for your usual 0-for-6 kid, but who happens to be 4-for-5 on the night? Or do you do something different?
Well, I'm a big what's the feel kind of a guy. Like, you know, I always believe, you know, in that situation, I would love to have something where I'm throwing the ball. Now, it's obviously different if I'm coaching men and coaching women. You know, I've always had something where I throw something at the rim, but not necessarily for that person to score and re-pass it. So I'd have one guy going up and he pass it to another to score. But obviously playing above the rim isn't something that we do on the women's side. However, I'm a lot more comfortable with consistent shooters when it comes to women. Because one thing I've noticed is that women that can knock down jump shots, unlike guys who can knock down jump shots. I remember Gerald Patio said this to me. Good shooters are good shooters because they take shots that they can hit. Women basketball players, you'll never see the Steph Curry equivalent on the women's side with moments running off the clock, shooting off balance, crazy, rushed 1-foot three-pointer. She's going to shoot her shot. And that's one thing that I love about the women's side is shooters shoot. They do what it is that they can do. So I actually have a few that can really shoot it, but I have one in particular right now that can shoot it. And in this same situation last year, we ran something and we drew it up on the sideline with just a few seconds left and got the shot we wanted. And she pulled that shot, and I'm talking about in and out. And she shot it like it was the first shot of the game. And I remember thinking to myself, that is the beauty of women's basketball players, is they do what they do. They don't try something new. They don't try to rush it and be flamboyant and fall on the ground and draw the foul and all that craziness. So I think as a women's coach, I would in particular have something in place that would get me either something off of a stagger, something off of a double, or a passer getting the ball back. Something where I can get the hands in the person that I know can knock down a shot under pressure in that situation, a good look. I wouldn't say that on the men's side. I think there's too many variables, the athleticism of the defense, the calls, whether on the road, at home. With the ladies, I just feel as though they are gonna do what they're gonna do. We could be playing in Staples, we could be playing at the park. And that's the consistency I love about the women's side. The uncertainty on the men's side is the reason that so many coaches are bald or have gray hair.
Okay, so then just to clarify here, which shooter are you going with for this play?
Any of my girls that are listening already know it's definitely Andre. Oh my goodness, I'm telling you, one day in practice, I think it was like 13 or 14, and now we're going up and down, and she's hitting shots, and the team is reacting like they're watching the game on television. I mean, she can literally just shoot the ball and shoot. There were games where she had a lull for a few games, and she just couldn't get off shots. She was not making shots. And one game, I guess she just decided, you know what, I'm just going to back up a little bit so I can get shots off. And she just went bananas. Like, you know, I mean, she really, really can shoot it. You know, my goal is to get her to shoot it a little quicker, you know, to be able to get off more shots, because she's such – and that's the other thing. You know, if she was the male equivalent, it'd be like, okay, enough shots. But we're literally saying we shoot the ball, you know. And that's the thing about her that makes her so good. I mean, she
lights out. So you're going with her even if she's 0 for 6 on the night over your kid who's 4 for 5?
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah. Now, you know, there's always situations, you know, my thing would be to incorporate both of them, maybe having that 4 for 5 kid, the one inbounding the ball, you know, just so that if that isn't the look we get, we do get it back to that person. But, you know, and I really think, too, that you create an environment in which the decision to go with one or the other doesn't dictate anything other than that moment. You know, I think a lot of damage and a lot of good are done to teams well before they get to that moment. What's done in the locker room, what's done in the summer, what's done through, you know, the voicemails and chats and all that kind of stuff. I think you create an environment in which those decisions can be made and no one is condemned for them. No one is held accountable in a negative or positive way. It's just what we needed to do at the moment. And from the good teams that I've been around, that's kind of the mentality of things. I think bad teams tend to have a whole bunch of those other little things that creep into the psyche of their team that, you know.
Absolutely. Yes. Well, Coach, thanks so much for coming on today. I really appreciate it. I'm glad that we got to sit down and chat. And I'm glad we did this now when you are a head coach and not, you know, a couple months ago. I mean, it wouldn't have made a difference, but it's kind of cool now that we're talking to you as a head coach.
Definitely, definitely. You know, it's definitely, I remember telling our vice president, she's asked me if I wanted to. I was like, I've been preparing for this for 40 years, so. You know, it's a long, long, long journey to here, but it's well worth it. And I'm really, really excited about the possibilities and really, really making our program one of the premier programs in the country. That's the goal. I don't bite my tongue about that. That's what we want to do. That's what our goal is year in, year out. We're going to graduate a lot of players. So we're excited about that as well.
Awesome. Well, good luck to you, Coach. I hope that you end up doing that. That would be great.